Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Justin Cohen, Executive Vice President at REQ, a full-service advertising agency that's been here in Vegas since 2009. We're proud members of the Vegas Chamber and collaborators with the Las Vegas Review-Journal. A special thank you to our sponsors for today's inaugural roundtable, Nevada State Bank and Southern Nevada Home Builders Association. Without your support, today would not have been possible. Together with these great organizations, we're proud to kick off the Vegas Thought Leadership Roundtable, streaming live from the top of the World Market Center in downtown Las Vegas. The roundtable was conceived to bring intellectual content to a community that deserves to hear from its best and brightest thought leaders. By creating insightful and impactful content that's accessible to all through our in-person and free live webinars, we aim to democratize access to our Valley's greatest minds. For our first topic, we decided to address Las Vegas real estate by posing the question, have we moved up a league? Right behind and below us is downtown Las Vegas, a skyline transformed by Circa, the first ground-up new casino hotel built downtown in decades, completed and opened during the heart of the pandemic. The vibrant pulse of Fremont East and the Arts District are core to the new Las Vegas experience, and we even have breweries, and they're awesome. This morning, out of my first run with long sleeves of the fall, I ran around Discovery Summit in Summerlin, where a stacked roster of the best golfers in the world are playing on a world-class private course that's home to many of the Valley's wealthiest individuals and some very prominent billionaires, all on land that was a mountain bike trail not long ago. Then there's the $2 billion Allegiant Stadium that seems to have become the topic of every Monday after a home game. Now, there's no hiding how I think and what I feel, but let's let the experts weigh in. We have a phenomenal panel of the best minds in real estate for you today. Jeremy Aguero of Applied Analysis, the region's premier research firm, will moderate our discussion and introduce our roundtable. We're aiming to save a little time at the end for Jeremy to take a couple questions from the online and in-person audiences. Please enter any questions you have into the chat. On behalf of the teams at REQ, Vegas Chamber, and Las Vegas Review-Journal, thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the roundtable. Jeremy, take it away.
Thank you. First of all, let me express my thanks for the opportunity to be here. I am very honored to be serving as a moderator to such a remarkable group of individuals. This is a thought leaders roundtable. Whether we've gone up a league or not, I suppose we'll find out by the end of this conversation. But I know that I'm sitting here with the A-League right now. My job here is relatively simple. Keep us on time and make sure that our topics remain on point. That having been said, I want to start with just introducing the folks that are up here with us in the room today. Immediately to my left is Brian Plaster, the Vice President of Signature Homes. You probably all know him. He's been in town, I think, almost forever, at least as long as I can remember, an avid outdoorsman and one of the most creative, I think, developers in our community, finding projects, finding ways to bring them to the market. He is remarkable in any number of ways, and I'm looking forward to what he has to say today. Immediately to his left is Audra Hamernick. I hope I pronounced the last name correctly. I practiced like seven times before we got in here, so I tried to do my best. The president and CEO of Nevada Hand. I'm sure everyone knows what Nevada Hand does and what Audra's sort of primary focus is. I can only imagine what you're dealing with today is our market struggles with this imbalance. I know we're going to learn a lot about that today. Immediately to her left is Brian Walsh, Senior Vice President of Land Sales and Development with Summerlin and Howard Hughes. Obviously, Summerlin is at the forefront and has been for a very long time in terms of master plan communities, essentially setting the standard, I think, nationally in terms of what we want to have as a master plan community. Thank goodness it's here in our own backyard. I can't tell you how happy I am to be up here with someone like you that has that kind of information. I know it's going to be incredibly compelling to the folks that are with us today. Immediately to Brian's left is Kristen Ralph Silverman, a partner with the Concordian Group. Forgive me, I worked on that one too, and apparently I'm just going to be tongue-tied today. Nonetheless, Kristen's with us, the foremost, I think, and I hope I'm not offending any other realtors out there today, but the foremost realtor, particularly in the high-end market, has set the mark in terms of any number of transactions and really demonstrated just how the high-end market can really be an incredibly important part of our real estate market here in Southern Nevada. And finally, to her left is Tim Erickson, Vice President of Sales and Leasing for Sun Commercial Real Estate. We're not going to get away, I'm sorry, with not being able to talk about commercial real estate. You're getting all of those questions today. Just so we're clear, we're going to be pressing you pretty hard. Obviously, some of them's got a little bit to do with that as well. So we'll throw a little few of those to Brian as we sort of walk through that. But we're really glad to have you here today because, you know, we talk a lot about the pandemic. We talk a lot about how things have changed recently and how the residential market has swung. But, you know, in all honesty, it's that office industrial commercial market that's really also changed dramatically post-pandemic. And I think it's worthy of quite a bit of our conversation here today. Obviously, we don't have a whole lot of time. I'm going to ask you to try to focus on the questions that we have. I know all of you could probably spend an hour just giving us your information. That having been said, that's about the amount of time we have for all of you to contribute. So let's try to focus and do our best to try and provide the best information we can. As thought leaders, I think focused on what may be the most important and pressing question that we have in our community today. You know, the topic that's in front of us today is this question of real estate, right? All of you are experts in that. But the sub question there is, have we moved up a league? And I hear it a lot, right? The real estate market has changed. It's different than it was before. We talk about the fact that housing prices are going up, we're outstripping. There's concern about that. Do we have enough supply on the market? All those things. We read it in the Review Journal every day. We read it in national publications every day. But the question that I get more than any other is this sustainable? Have we actually moved up a league? Or are we really just sort of leaning into the next bubble? Is that really what we're seeing relative to that, right? I get it. I get a lot of that. You know, Chris and Brian, I'd like to sort of put this question to you first. Maybe, Chris, you can help us. I mean, look, you're on the front lines every day talking to folks that are trying to sell homes, talking to folks that want to buy homes. I can only imagine what that's like in today's market. I mean, it's been feverish for the better part of, you know, during a period where everybody said, you know, oh, the market's going to sort of collapse. It's done exactly the opposite. So here we sit, you know, mid-October, maybe we're on the other side of a pandemic, at least we feel like we're that way. Tell us, what do you see? Have we moved up a league or really are we sort of leaning into something that's just not sustainable?
Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for having me. We certainly have moved up a league. The foreclosure crisis that we knew, that was caused largely by the mortgage industry giving free money to unverified people that caused a frenzy of complete investor buying that was completely unsustainable. That isn't the case this time. The driver and the buyer in this market is totally different. The whole market is shifting upwards because of a lack of supply. Pure and simple. The drivers for this great reshuffling, as we know, the pandemic caused everybody to look for greener pastures. That translated to people moving all over the place to different places. Urbanites moving to rural places, if you will, because they could work from home. Buyers were in search of cheaper, lower prices and more affordable lifestyles. Because of the work for home options, home became more important and cheap money let buyers stretch their dollars, let them move up. Rising construction prices have something to do with that, certainly driving the cost escalation, but it's mostly due to a change in clientele that's what we're seeing in Las Vegas. These buyers, unlike the ones in the foreclosure crisis that were really fake buyers with fake money, these buyers are just more wealthy and inclined to spend more. The buyer this time isn't an investor, it's a primary home buyer. Out-of-state buyers have bigger budgets. We get buyers from across the country, no doubt, but California is our biggest driver. We're also experiencing kind of a network effect. And by that, I mean, once that one primary buyer comes in from, let's say, California, that's the influencer, he's influencing all of his friends and family to move here too. So we have a complete shift, not of just an individual, but of groups. And, you know, ironically, and we can talk, this is a whole different conversation, but many people on the upper end of the income spectrum are actually emerging out of the pandemic with more wealth than they were, than they had in the beginning of it. So while the lack of supply has shifted our market up, real cash rather than fake borrowed money is now here and solidified that we've moved up a league.
So Brian, let me throw it to you then, right? I mean, what Kristen just said largely is talking about the inflow of capital, right? We know 40, 45% of the population migration, where we're back up at or near the nation's highest in terms of population migration. And it's great because a lot of those folks are bringing huge amounts of home equity, primarily from California, moving in, and that's stimulating that into the market. But the market's so large and there's so many elements to that. So when you look at it, I mean, obviously that's creating a real push up in the league, but are you seeing that across the board? Are you seeing that in the broader spectrum of the residential market?
Yes, Jeremy. Thank you very much for inviting me, by the way, and thank you for having me on the panel. I think we have moved up a league, and I think that we're seeing, it feels like we're moving up a league. I don't know if you could say it's a definite thing at this point in time, because we're still feeling the impacts of that. But I think on the apartment side, we're seeing rents go up faster than we've ever seen them go up in this community. And I think it's putting a lot of pressure on the individual renter. We're seeing rents up 25% from January this year until now. And renewals are skyrocketing, and then new rentals are going up quite a bit as well. And I think that's putting more pressure on the average renter today. And I think we're going to start to see some of those negative effects maybe affecting the community, where people have less money to spend on other things in the economy, entertainment, food, things like that. And that's one of my bigger concerns, is kind of as we move up a league and more of our population is having to spend more of their income on housing. We've typically been about, less than a third of our income's going, been dedicated toward housing. But then you look at communities like New York City, 50%, no problem. LA, no problem, 50%. So I think we're moving in that direction, where you're seeing more people having to spend more of their income on their housing. And I think that that's going to change how our community is digesting the housing market over time.
So it almost feels, Brian, like maybe my question was almost the wrong question. Maybe we can move up a league because that's what we've become, right? I mean, we're sort of evolving as a community, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily sustainable in that regard.
True, because are the jobs and are the wages going up? I mean, if you look at the job numbers, are we still down 70,000 jobs? You might be paying a little bit more attention to that. So we might have the population going up, but if people aren't working, what does that really do to our community? And I think that if we don't have the jobs to support our economy, then we're going to see some problems somewhere.
Yeah, look, I hope we have time to get to this question of economic development and what drives that growth going forward. But before we do that, look, Brian Walsh, let me ask you. I mean, you deal with land and development, Summerlin. I mean, the 22,000 acre master plan community, has a little something for everyone in that community, and has really been, as I said earlier, a national standard. I mean, you see where we're going in terms of community-based development, what people are seeking when they come. So let me ask you this question. I mean, as you look today and you see where we are, the with a lot of the dialogue that just came up in our conversation today, where do we go? Where does Summerlin go next? Where do we go next in terms of major master plan communities that are trying to drive that forward?
Again, thank you for inviting me here today. And from Summerlin's standpoint, I think we just keep doing what we've been doing. We are almost 20,000 acres into our master plan. We still have over 5,000 acres remaining. Every couple of years, 2 years, we release a brand new village, has a new theme, has new architecture. We try to keep things fresh. So nothing about Vegas or Summerlin is ever stale. It's always new. And I've had relatives come visit me from the East Coast, where I grew up, and they say, everything here seems new. Everything here seems fresh. And whether you look at it as Vegas as a whole, or what we're doing with our sporting events, teams coming in, or even Summerlin as a master plan, every couple of years, it's something new. It feels new. And we finally gotten to a point, certainly in Summerlin, where you look at downtown Summerlin, that's really evolving into something where in itself, it's its own bubble. It's its own economy. You never have to leave Summerlin. And more than 50% of the new home sales in Summerlin are to people who already live there. So it's really becoming its own engine of growth. You almost don't need people coming in from the outside to keep the growth going. But that's what we're seeing in Las Vegas right now, a great influx from California. But within Summerlin itself, We're just going to keep doing what we're doing, developing new downtowns, which we are in our Western Summerlin, and continuing to provide a variety of products to all of the home buyers, not just luxury, but we have everything from townhomes to condos to luxury, a new custom lot community coming out of the ground in 2 years. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing in Summerlin.
That's terrific, and I get it. Are there any obstacles to that for you guys, though? Is there anything that keeps you up at night and saying, hey, look, we know we're doing good. And look, I had a conversation with a client right before I came here talking about economic development and what we need to change and all those type of things. And the ultimate conclusion that I gave him is the best thing we can do to attract new businesses to come here is to make sure this is the best place for existing businesses that are here to operate. I mean, that's as good as it can get. And it seems like that's almost a central theme of Summerlin, right? We're going to keep doing what we're doing because we believe we're doing it right for all the people that call it home. 25,000 acres, that's a lot of folks. I mean, it's a city in and of itself, like you said, self-contained relative to all that. But let me ask the question, in terms of looking forward, what keeps you up? I mean, is there anything that's going to cause that to have a hiccup? I mean, maybe it's an external force, maybe it's an internal force. I don't know. But is there anything that can prohibit you from doing what you want to do?
I think short term, what keeps everybody up is supply chain issues. And it's not just materials. It's not me getting, you know, steel pipe that takes 6 months to fabricate. It's also the labor force and just getting operators to operate the equipment. NV Energy, they're inspectors in the field. You go to the county, do they have plant checkers? I mean, every single facet of our business is short of labor. I think I could say that everywhere. And that's what keeps me up at night in the short term. You know, in the long term, and you know, do we look at our water supply here in Las Vegas, which I think that from a water supply standpoint, the Water Authority has done a remarkable job making sure our supply is secure for a long time. It's the water conservation is where we need to focus our effort. And that's on us. That's in everybody in this room. It's every water user where you hear about turf removal. We also hear about, you know, do we turn our clock, our sprinkler clocks back to 3 days a week, which only 55% of all the water users do that. And that's the single biggest way we can conserve. So long-term water supply doesn't keep me awake at all. I mean, it's secure. It's water conservation. I think that's where we need to focus. You know, Howard Hughes and Summerlin's doing their part for that. But getting back to it, it's just the labor supply. Materials will somehow figure that out. Labor, I don't know how we figure that out. I don't know how we convince people to come here. And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's an inspector or a site superintendent or people I'm trying to hire, I have vacancies I can't fill. I think that's the single biggest thing that keeps me awake in the short term. Yeah, how do we solve that?
I certainly hope that some of that starts to correct itself, right, as our economy sort of finds its way there. Like, and something you said in the middle, I mean, Summerlin has really been a model in terms of sustainability and how to grow and develop in the desert since the beginning. But I think some of the things you've done most recently, particularly with the new portions of development, really trying to preserve the landscape and build into the landscape, it's really, again, been a model for other folks have done. All right, Audrey, you know I wasn't going to let you get away here. I mean, I think under about half the questions, the responses that we've had, probably more than that, has been the sort of underpinning of affordability, right? Everybody wants to talk about it. I know that historically we did some work with you all a long time ago dealing with this concept of the missing middle, right? We have folks that can receive some kind of support at the low end. We have folks that can afford things at the high end, and we've got people that are being left out. We had a little bit of a conversation on some of the challenges that you're dealing with, but at the end of the day, affordability seems to be this theme that that people want to talk about, but they don't seem to have any solution to. So let me just throw it out to you. What are we dealing with from an affordability standpoint? Are we already sort of at a crisis? Are we heading toward a crisis? I mean, what do you see there? You deal with it every day in Nevada. Hey.
I wish I had awesome news for you. we just don't. So Nevada Hand is an affordable housing developer. We're the largest in the state. We have about 4,600 units in our portfolio. But the big thing to remember is affordability to us means we're watching two things. One is our rent levels, and second are the incomes of the folks that live in our buildings. So to give you just a little bit of sense of that, for a family of four to be a lower income to qualify for one of our buildings, it's around $47,000 a year. So that's the facts. The sad part of this is we're getting 2,000 calls a day right now asking for affordable housing. It's a big deal. The estimate that we're seeing right now is that Southern Nevada is 84,000 units down. That's our gap of what is affordable rental. Average rental right now, let's say it's 1600 in the marketplace. We're 733. That's our average rent. So you can see that we're very different. We are not public housing. So I want to make that clear. We're a nonprofit and we own our own buildings. So the interesting thing is we have family properties and senior properties. Our senior portfolio is exactly what you would imagine in your head. Our families, they're working families, right? They're paying what we hope to be about a third of their income for rent and for all housing costs, so utilities as well. So where are we at? Tough, right? This fall, we'll have 900 units under construction. We're really proud of that. And then we say, oh yeah, but then there's 84,000 more we need. So we cannot keep up with that. I guess the big thing that I always hear people talk about is, you know, what's the magic? Like, I think it's like the three little pigs. They think that we have some magic in the buildings that we're building, right? Or somehow we have like magic construction costs, but no, I mean, we're just the same as everybody on this table. We're dealing with building codes, right? Just like everybody else. We're dealing with affordable housing, what I call affordable housing plus. It's where a municipality or the state says, yeah, do this, but do this too, right? Make affordable housing something for every single, or try to solve lots of social problems with just building affordable housing. And sometimes people just need a place they can afford, right? And then other times they need wraparound services or other things. So to answer your question, there's not a lot of great entry points right now. We're seeing tons of people doubling up. Even in our own staff, we have found during COVID, we've learned more than what we've ever wanted to know about our employees, right? And they are doubled up. We have what I would call kind of a traditional family that's renting a room in their house to a stranger, so they can pay the rent. So it's a weird place right now, and there's a lot of room for growth.
And so let me ask the question, has the demand increased? I mean, you're talking about the from the supply side, the ability to bring those on, but during the pandemic, obviously we had eviction moratoriums. We still saw population growth. We had a lot of stimulus in the market. We had a lot of programs that were at least designed to keep people in. We're gonna talk more about some of the Federal Reserve and some of the things that they're doing. But, you know, is this demand side issue for the folks that you're seeing every day, are you able to place these? Are you able to sort of point them in the right direction? Are you able to sort of get them where they need to go? Or are we sort of heading to, I don't want to call it a crisis, but are we heading to where there's a sufficient imbalance that at some point policymakers are going to have to take notice because we've got a real disconnect and it's getting larger and maybe it's something we couldn't see as much during the pandemic because there was so much stimulus in the market. But today, right, where are we going to be as this sort of evolves?
I'm going to sound like a drama queen, but oh yeah, it's crisis right now. Like 100% crisis right now. And it's part of what Brian was talking about. You know, the demand is increasing for lots of different reasons, but one of the biggie that's obvious is rent's increasing. So when folks are living in an apartment they can afford, now they get the renewal notice, it's 25% higher. They don't have the cash. So now what? So they're calling folks like Nevada Hand, and we have no vacancies. Like we have 4,600 units, there are no vacancies. We're in crisis mode. And what really concerns me is exactly back to your labor question. Where do the housekeepers live? Where do people live that fund and house and clean and serve? Where do all these people live that support our business community? So we think we're in crisis mode.
Brian, like I said in during your introduction, I mean, I know you're in the process of looking at multifamily housing and finding ways to transition that housing and to get it on the market. And again, as I said at the beginning, you've been very creative in that regard. I think doing things that other folks haven't been willing to do. You know, as we hear what Audra says and we think about that, you know, I'm struck with what type of creative options are kind of out there. What does entry level housing, what is that today? I mean, I remember when I first started out, probably when we first started out, you're a little younger than I am, I suppose, but you know, entry level housing was like a thing, right? You know, you're talking about doubling up and some of the challenges that are out there, right? What options do we have as a market to sort of address this challenge that Audra's put forward?
I think we're running out of options. We're running out of land in a lot of ways. I think multifamily is going to be the way to house people, but we're going to have to you know, build more density closer to town so people can have access to the job centers, building multi, you know, high density properties way out in this, you know, in way out of North Las Vegas or way out in Henderson, I don't really think benefit as much as they do, you know, down here. But I think getting back to the affordable, you know, the entry level housing question, I think the general public is kind of screwed here. I think that they won't be able to even buy an entry level single family house within 5 to 10 years. I think that the single family for rent guys are actually going to be buying all of the entry level homes over the next decade, in my opinion. I think we're going to see huge funds. D.R. Horton is already building out properties in South Carolina, for instance, putting all 48 houses on the market as kind of one development. And I think we're going to see a shift from people even being able to buy a single family house to having to maybe buy a resale home. And I think the new home builders are really going to be focused on that move up buyer. So I think most of the new homes in a few years are going to be 500,000 plus, and it's going to be the move up buyer that's looking to buy it in those communities. And I think the home builders will continue to have a strong market and they'll continue to build. But I think that the entry level homeowner or anyone trying to buy a brand new home is going to have a very, very tough time as the years go by. I don't think there's going to be much of a slowdown in the home price appreciation. I think we might level out a little bit, but it definitely feels like we're in a new realm here in Las Vegas with the way the prices have firmed up. And going back to what Kristen was saying is these are different buyers now. These guys have a lot more money. The millennials have saved a lot more money. They're becoming more home buyers now. And I think that we're definitely seeing a shift in how the entry level buyer will be even able to buy in the future.
All right. I think I need a little bit of a break from talking about residential then. So Tim, I'm shifting over to you for a little bit. Right. I mean, we spent a while talking about some pretty significant trends and how our market has changed. Right. You know, I guess one notable one that we've talked about a lot during the past 18, 19 months has been more people working from home. You know, this sort of shift. I know in my office, there's been folks that I think preferred doing some of that. Obviously, that transition has affected the way many of us do business today. But as you look at it from a commercial real estate standpoint, what are you seeing? I mean, we're still seeing projects be developed. We've got office, industrial, and retail projects that are out there. But, you know, with more people working from home and maybe changing, do you see that dramatically impacting the commercial real estate markets? Or do you figure, you know, it's just going to take us a little bit of time to get back to exactly where we were pre-pandemic?
Yeah. Well, I think that initially, that was everyone's thought, was that the work from home was going to kind of be a real, you know, death nail in the coffin of the office space and whatnot. But we really haven't seen that materialize so much. And I think it's probably been propped up in large part just by what was mentioned earlier. We have a large number of people moving here from California and other states, and looking at just the total, you know, net absorption of office space in the last 12 months was basically even. It was about 15,000 square feet. And I think a lot of people were predicting, you know, a huge increase in vacancy, but vacancy has held pretty constant at just under 12% for the last year, which sounds like a high number if you're not familiar with the office market. But, you know, after the 2008-09 recession, our office vacancy was closer to 30%. It's been on a slowed downward trend ever since, and hanging out just under 12 is actually, you know, the lowest we've seen since, you know, before that 2008-09 recession. So we really haven't seen it materialize. I think, again, in large part propped up by, you know, the huge number of people moving here. Obviously, you know, maybe in other markets where they don't have that huge influx of people, they might see a little bit more pain in the office sector. But so far, you know, net absorption's been flat. You know, we're helped by the fact that there aren't a lot of new deliveries in office space. I think it was only a couple hundred thousand square feet last year. But, you know, and even rents had a small increase of about 4.4% year over year. So in office space, it's held up okay. As far as the other commercial product types, you know, industrial demand has just continued to go through the roof. You know, I mentioned only a couple hundred thousand square feet of office space being delivered, but they actually had 5.3 million square feet of industrial space finished over the last year, and net absorption of 8.1 million square feet. So we're absorbing it faster than we're building it in industrial. Vacancies down to below 4% now, and rents in industrial were up almost 9% over the last year. So, you know, I think we're going to see that trend continuing, especially as the, you know, convention and other tourism businesses come back up. We've been
bombarded with calls over the last couple months from people in the businesses that service the conventions looking for warehouse space, and they just can't find it. So I think that trend is only going to continue as we come out of the pandemic and things start to return to normal in that regard. So, I think one of the concerns voiced by the other panelists on the residential side was just lack of, land and supply. And we're definitely seeing that in industrial. And it's a trend that, I think is unfortunately going to continue for the next little while.
So let me follow up on that, what you said there at the end, right? I think we've all heard the same thing. I bet everybody in the room and everybody sitting here has dealt with this fact that we don't have enough land, right? That we're going to start to run out of land. Now, maybe I need to have a conversation with Brian a little bit about this, because he's got some land out there that apparently that they're interested in selling to folks and develop. But before we get to the residential side, now I want to have that conversation in a moment. But, from the commercial industrial side, particularly as it relates to industrial, I'm hearing, or we're seeing escalation in pricing, I think the number of large parcels that we have here in the urban valley is somewhat limited. We've had success from an economic development standpoint, things like Haas Automation out in West Henderson and what they're developing, some of the other things that are happening there. But as you take a look at some of the constraints in terms of our ability to continue to see the type of absorption that you talked about, to continue to meet the demand. And Kristen talked about a lot of people moving in, and I'm imagining, and I'm going to ask you about this in a little bit, about how many of those are business owners. They're not just high wealth individuals. They're also bringing businesses with them. And we know that the number one reason for someone to relocate to Southern Nevada is for a job related activity. That's what brings folks here. So when we think about it from that standpoint, and you look at the land constraints that are out there, does it concern you? Do you see sort of an end to our ability to continue to build as much, for example, industrial space as we've seen over the past couple of years?
Definitely concerned about it. I think a lot of people who aren't deeply involved in the real estate industry might think there should be ample land in Vegas because we're in the middle of the desert. But the truth is, most of it's controlled by the BLM, who's very slow to release more land. And so we, really have seen even a huge increase in just land values for development for industrial spaces. I think in the Southwest, we've seen parcels trade over $20 a square foot now for industrial land. And out in the Northeast, probably more like $10 or so, which is why the vast majority of the new construction is happening out there, where it's still a little bit more affordable. But definitely, as that starts to fill out, there's, real concern about where's the next chunk going to come from. I think several years ago, people had dreamed up this big project out in Apex, out further northeast outside of town, and it never really materialized. But I think, we're getting close to the point where that might actually be a solution for some people. That it does have the rail running through it. So I think if they can develop a spur out there and get the rest of the utilities and services out there, then you might start to see that become kind of the next place people look to go as the rest of the land in town dries up.
So with all the stimulus that's come in, obviously the focus of the stimulus has been on direct payments to individuals, businesses, those type of things. The EDA grants, the Economic Development Agency grants coming in to Nevada, at least pretend to be, at least there's some suggestion, probably a better way to say that, that those may open up some additional corridors, including, as you mentioned, Apex. This is not intended to be a political dialogue. I don't want to take it down that road, but obviously the next stimulus program is largely infrastructure based. Do you believe that could be something that can help Southern Nevada open up some of these corridors and create some of those new opportunities?
So potentially, it depends what they, decide is the infrastructure of priority. But if that involves getting a rail spur and, sewer, water, power, all those services out to the Apex land, then I definitely think that'll be a spot that people look for, in the future development. Some of the largest companies absorbing our industrial space have been large distribution centers, because people are starting to view Vegas as kind of this hub to be able to distribute, their products to the whole Southwest part of the country, Southern California, Arizona, Utah, everywhere. So, as those spaces continue to get eaten up, if, it becomes actually feasible to, develop out there because you have the services in place you know, rail access and all that, then I definitely see that as a possibility.
All right, Brian, I told you I was going to come back to you on this one, right? I mean, from a commercial side, we hear it all the time in terms of land availability. I think what Tim just said was on point, right? The ability for infrastructure to open up and create opportunities. You know, it seems to me that Summerlin creates, Howard Hughes creates those opportunities by building in a huge amount of infrastructure, by essentially building its own parks, building its own roads, getting ahead of that demand instead of always being behind it. But as we think about this issue of land constraint, obviously Summerlin has a ton of land still to bring into the system. Are you concerned relative to land availability in the broader urban valley? Or do you think that we have it, it just might not be in the right place and just might not be utilized as effectively as it could be?
Thank you for pointing out how happy I am to work for a master plan that still has 5,000 acres left. Not something I worry about day to day. But of course, I'm worried about land availability. You know, we have a number of home builder customers, and Summerlin can't be the only source of land for them. We're very careful about how we sell land, how often we sell it. We monitor the builders, you know, lot supply. We want to make sure that at any given time, any one of our home builder customers has at least a 2 to 3 year supply of lots on their books. And we don't want to undersupply land to our builders. We don't want to oversupply either. And the ability for us to build these villages, it's a massive amount of capital to put in the infrastructure, water, sewer. We do all that ourselves. We build our own water reservoirs now, all of our parks. I mean, that does not come cheap. So you don't want to overbuild and then devalue your land by trying to sell too much. So, you know, with that said, what applies to Summerlin applies to everybody else. It's very expensive to build these parcels. And I am concerned about the, you know, the supply of land throughout the valley. You know, I'm very happy with where we are in Summerlin, but, you know, it's something I hear all the time as far as the amount of land that's available out there. And I know that there's a lands bill that's going through Congress. And, you know, I think people have made more of that than what it is. But I think that's very important that get passed for a number of reasons. Again, back to Summerlin, you know, we're very careful about our commercial because we own all of our own apartments. We own our own office building, downtown Summerlin, you know, that's our own operating assets. So we don't too often sell a commercial parcel, but residential, we sell all of that. Again, as far as land supply, you know, it is something that we monitor on a daily basis, not just in Summerlin, but everywhere else in the valley.
So Kristen, I alluded to it just a few minutes ago about this concept of, I mean, obviously you're a leader, if not the leader in the high-end market. And as I said previously, sort of on the front lines, right? I imagine that a lot of that, as you mentioned before, is, to use a term that I think my daughter would use, influencers coming into our community and they bring other folks with them to sort of follow. And let's be perfectly honest, the economics work out pretty well for them. If you're a high net worth individual living in California, your options to not only acquire a home, but preserve more of your wealth here in Southern Nevada is valuable. And so that's a value proposition for making that move. But I'd like to ask you a question about economic development, right? Are a lot of those buyers or a lot of those folks that are coming in tied to some type of economic development, tied to some kind of business, tied to some kind of economic pursuit that is also bringing them to our community? Is there sort of that economic element that underlies the drive for that residential market, particularly at the high end?
Yes, certainly. The drivers of the new demand are kind of the same ones that we had, and then the same ones or the new ones that we are going to have, hopefully. So, you know, the same drivers that we have is that we're affordable. I think our biggest driver is the fact that we're a zero tax state. I look at that a lot. There's seven other states. I feel like I compete against all of those other states rather than agents. You know, I'm not really competing against agents. I'm competing against Texas and Florida primarily for that wealth and that buyer to come to Vegas. So I think that our tax advantage is certainly driving our buyers here. So I think that we definitely need to keep our zero tax status, you know. So for us, the the cost of living is much lower. And then, of course, our entertainment lifestyle. The only thing is, if we don't have our city open, we don't have our entertainment lifestyle. So that there in lies that juxtaposition. You're coming here, you're bringing your business, but you need business to be open. So I think that the, you know, our reliance on tourism as our primary driver of our economy makes us vulnerable. So that makes us need to diversify our economy, certainly, so, and create a new demand. So I think that those, a lot of that is happening there. I think that, you know, on the new demand side, you know, and we talked about this just a little bit, but, you know, of course, like, you know, higher tides raise all ships, right? So you've got, and what makes a ship stable is the middle of that ship. You've got the upper end that I'm dealing with, Audra's dealing with the lower end, and those are tipping points. It can tip one way or the other. So that middle, if we can just pull in the middle, that balances us out, that balances our ship. And to do that, I really think that, you know, we need a more educated work population. So, because that's going to drive in a lot of businesses. And so when you see that lower end and that higher end, they tend to be maybe renters on this side and retirees or empty nesters on this side, no kids on this side. That middle is grounded by probably people that have kids in school. So, and so that's, you know, we know what we're good at. We know we're good at zero tax state. We know we're good at affordable living. We know that, or an affordable living lifestyle relative, you know, to other cities, and that we're great at entertainment. What we need to get good at, we know that we're not so good at schools. And so education and bringing up the level of our education, period, for sure, is what's going to bring up our middle. It will bring in more people and bring in, you know, will drive that middle market into our marketplace. So we need that. We need you know, fundamentally, every great city, education is fundamental to every great city. And I think that, you know, also some drivers, some new drivers. I think about this a lot. Just, you know, I look at Summerlin and how great they've done with building communities. We used to come, you know, most people used to come here to visit, and now we're living here. And in doing that, you need to create communities and where people gather. And I don't mean by a strip mall. That's not a community. They're cool, but what is cooler is downtown Summerlin and the uncommons and places for people to gather and to live and to work and to spend money and to spend time together. So I think that the developers are filling this in now and doing a great job. I mean, you know, that's something that we didn't have 10 years ago. And so I think that that's a big driver. I also, interestingly enough, I think that I look at a lot of destination cities where people want to move and what are those drivers. And they tend to be well-rounded cities. And what I mean by that, they're not just one thing there. So I think that where I see Vegas having a lot of runway is probably, ironically, in our natural resources. We've got a lot of areas for outdoor activities, hiking, fishing, photography, boating, skiing. All those can drive all of that can drive businesses around it. And I think Vegas has a lot of runway to develop those areas. And maybe, you know, looking at health as our newest amenity for Las Vegas, if you look at it that way. So I think that those are some of the drivers.
Great. Thank you. Brian, let me ask you a question. I mean, we're talking a lot about where we are today and, you know, the, how, I don't know a better term, almost feverish the market is today. One of the reasons I think that plays into that, and I think we can all agree, is remarkably low interest rates, right? The ability to access a home is better than I think it's ever been in any of our lives, just relative to how low the cost of borrowing is. You know, the Federal Reserve Bank has indicated that they're going to increase that rate. I think that's somewhat inevitable. They can't make it a whole lot lower than it is right now. How concerned are you relative to the fact that maybe we've accelerated some of the buying that we would have had otherwise as a result of very low interest rates? And essentially by doing that, as those interest rates start to come up, there's going to kind of be a lull on the other side of that.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think the home builders have been experiencing they've been having to kind of monitor how much land they're selling to the buyers these days. And I think that's why we haven't seen the sales numbers just go absolutely crazy, because I think we obviously have supply chain issues and we can't deliver the homes like we used to. But I do think that you do have kind of a little bit of a wave that could have happened that didn't happen because of all these issues. So I think that that eventually will catch up with itself, you know, 6 months, 12 months down the line. But I think that, you know, you'll have a little bit of a perfect storm with interest rates rising, demand kind of slowing down a little bit. So hopefully prices stop going through the roof at some point in time. And hopefully those two factors happening at the same time, maybe in the next 12 to 18 months, will put us on a more sustainable path than, you know, what we've seen in the last, you know, what, year or so, with the 25% growth in our price appreciation on houses. And on the multifamily side too. I mean, you're seeing cap rates getting compressed incredibly low. How long does that last for? That's a really interesting question too, because the cap rates are going to follow the 10-year interest rate. And as those cap rates start to go back up, what happens to the values of these properties? You know, because there'll be some cap rate compression has been good for the apartment developers and apartment owners over the last few years, but then it'll start going the other way at some point if interest rates rise too much. So it's definitely going to be a little bit choppy with the Federal Reserve over the next little bit. But however, I started my career as a loan officer back in Texas in 2004. And back then when I was doing loans, we were doing loans for 5.5%, 6%. And when I was first getting into that business, everyone told me, hey, these are the lowest interest rates you're ever going to see in your career. They can't ever get lower. And interest rates have done nothing in my career but get lower over time. And I was at a conference a little while ago, and they felt the cap rates could actually go even lower than they currently are, which surprised me. But when Signature Homes first started out in the early 80s, we were selling homes with interest rates of 19, 20%. And the home market was still fine. So I don't know if the interest rate is going to affect the demand as much as just, you know, our community, you know, Summerlin building great product, Signature Homes building great product out there. You know, we're going to see, you know, a lot of people wanting to come to this community for other factors that we've discussed today. So I think even if interest rates do rise, we still can sell homes.
So Signature Homes started in 1978, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Correct.
Right, so that's the Carter administration. We've made it made some distance between now and then. Hopefully those interest rates remain low. Hopefully we don't go back to that. But, you know, I mean, that's a lot of the conversation, right? Record low interest rates and yet in inflation starting to rise. And so, Audrey, let me ask you this question. I mean, it seems like the deck, is stacked against some of the sort of home buyers that are trying to access the market, trying to be a renter, trying to get that person, trying to stay where they are. You know, we worry about inflation. We worry about interest rates rising. We worry about supply side. And as Brian talked about, rapid increases in pricing. You know, the other side of it, I want to believe that some portion of the $5.3 trillion that we generated in stimulus and the plus or minus $6 billion that the state of Nevada still has and will work to allocate over some extended period of time is going to at least provide some relief, some help, some programs that can help folks either stay in their home or access a new home. Because you talked about, if I'm remembering the number correctly, 84,000 people that are sort of, that's the number we're short in terms of what we need to supply. So let me ask the question, is there any news, any sort of relief, anything that we can sort of hope that maybe there's some programs that can help make it better for some folks?
Okay, I actually have good news on this one.
Oh, I knew it.
Okay, so let's talk about rental assistance. So the EAP dollars that came into the state, Nevada's doing great. We're 10th in the nation on getting those funds out the door. a lot of states are really struggling with this because remember, they were dumped a bunch of money. They're not housing authorities. They don't know how to get those funds out the door. So Nevada is doing great on this. We've spent 42% of our rental assistance dollars. So what that means just to a company like Nevada Hand. So we've received $1 million on behalf of our residents of rental assistance to help keep them housed. So that's a big deal. We do have resident services coordinators at each of our sites that help people do this, because I can guarantee you, any one of us sitting down this afternoon trying to fill out this application, we would struggle. It's not easy. So we've been really fortunate. So yes, I think that's absolutely worked. I'm really interested to see what happens to the American Rescue Plan dollars that come into the community. I mean, we're still at interim rule right now. There are four main, you know, buckets that are in there. Public safety, which is where affordable housing comes into it. We have public safety, government services. We have basically hazard pay, and then three really specific infrastructure pieces. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. Now, Clark County, they have $440 million, 150 of that they've really reserved for affordable housing. We're trying really hard to advocate for all the different groups to use that money really smart and stretch the dollars through taxes and bonds and other things. We're watching infrastructure bill really closely. There's a 202 program and an 811 program, both for seniors and people with disabilities. It's a real funding source to help grandma be able to live somewhere when she is only living on Social Security for the rest of her life in a beautiful, safe building. So there's just a lot of things that are on the edge we just don't know a lot about. We primarily use low-income housing tax credits. The reconciliation bill has an expansion of tax credits. So we're not short of capital, right? There should be plenty of capital. We are short of workers. We are short of land. Someone mentioned BLM. Yeah, it's great if all the stars align perfectly, right? I mean, for people like us, they're always like, I want to BLM. Why don't you get the land? Yeah. It could work. But once that land is transferred, I have 1 year to build. And you can imagine all the strings I've got attached to our financing. We're slow money.
Yeah. Look, our times, number one, I'm going to end on something that's positive. So thank you for that. Our time is about up. So I want to just ask one question in the 30 seconds we have remaining. Right? Let's imagine that the wonderful sponsors and everyone that brought us here today brings us back 1 year from today. I'd like each one of you to tell me just whether we're better off, worse off, or about the same from a real estate market. Tim, I'm going to start with you.
I think better off, mostly driven by the pent-up demand that is still, you know, waiting to be unleashed in the aftermath of the pandemic. And as has been mentioned by other panelists, people continue to move here because of our tax status and all that. So, yeah, I think we're better off a year from now.
Kristen, what do you think? Better off, worse off, about the same?
100% better.
I love the optimism. All right, Brian, you're up.
Far better off.
Far better off.
Far better off. A year ago when sales started picking up, you didn't know if those sales were going to last. If it was a 1 or 2 month yep. thing, it was going to go back. Now we have confidence, whatever sale, part of the sales you're in, that it's going to continue. We are so much better off.
Audra?
I'm in a different marketplace. Yep. So I'm competing with land by the acre with everyone sitting here, right? I'm not getting any freebies. I'm going to say about the same, only because I know these ARP dollars, they have to be obligated by the end of 2024. So I think it's going to be more like 2023 for me to be better.
Mr. Plaster.
I think it just depends if you're a renter or an owner.
Just depends.
If you're an owner, you're going to be happier at the end of 2022. Yep. If you're a renter, you're not.
There you go. Look, I just want to express my heartfelt thanks for all of you. This is a thought leaders roundtable. You are absolutely that. This community is lucky to have each and every one of you here, and I'm very honored to have shared this stage. So thank you all for being here. My job now is to turn the mic back over to our MC and go from there. Oh, terrific. Yeah, I didn't know if I'm going to hand those to you. Do you want me to ask? Are there any questions? We have a few minutes for questions. Yeah, please.
All right, so we're talking about our moving into a new era here. I know several of the panelists have been here for many years, many decades in some cases. What do we think about downtown? We have a distinctly different downtown, right? Our biggest industry doesn't house in a business district, right? They house in their own industry and their own hotels. What do we think is going on with downtown? And is that moving us up into a different stratosphere?
I think it's a great question. Who wants to jump in to what's going to happen downtown? Oh, come on. Somebody's going to have to do it there, Brian.
I think I might be more prepared than we do own a property downtown. So I've spent a lot of time down here. I think with developments like F9, I think that's really showing a positive direction for downtown, but we need more of those, frankly. We need more residents living downtown, but you are seeing some really, really great momentum. The beer district, the brewery district that we just has kind of, I guess, been generated in the last year or two is phenomenal. Frankly, we're getting a lot of new restaurants down there as well. Esther's, I'll plug Esther's. That's a great restaurant. One of my favorites. Just in general, I think that with the two new housing developments we've seen, Arik, and I can't recall the other one, in Symphony Park, I think those are going to help change the community quite a bit. And that's going to bring a new demographic into downtown that we have not seen before. Your minimum rents there are going to be probably $1,700-$1,800 for a one bedroom, up to probably $3,000 for twos and three bedrooms down there. So you're going to have a much higher end demographic down there. And I think that's going to help support a lot of the newer restaurants and businesses that are going to be coming down here. So I think that as long as we continue to see these developers do well on their apartments, I think we'll continue to see more rooftops get developed downtown. And I think we'll see the businesses, the restaurants, the bars kind of follow. There's even a handful of gyms that are popping up. And really what I lived in Austin, Texas for a while back in the early 2000s. And it's really starting to remind me of South Congress, kind of South Main Street and kind of going into the brewery district down that way. I think we're really starting to see similarities to kind of that hip, funky Austin 89104 thing. I'm getting the zip code wrong. But anyways, it's definitely starting to really pop down there. And I'm really, really happy with how downtown's going. And I think that that's really the place to live. Downtown Summerlin's great, but I think downtown Las Vegas is a little bit better place to live. If you're 23, 24, 25, and you want to go out and do your thing, I think it's going
to
be better.
Look, I don't really know that there has to be one that's better and one that's worse, but I think you make a really interesting point relative to that. We've been around long enough to remember what downtown was like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Right, I hear this argument about unfulfilled promise and where we're headed and all those type of things. Downtown's come a long, long way over the past 10 years, right? I think it's done remarkable things. It's going to take another decade, maybe another two, to maybe fulfill the promise that we all can imagine what downtown might be. We look at, what happened in Austin. We look at Lodo in Denver. We look at the Gas Lamp District in San Diego. We aspire to be these type of things. But let's not forget, it took a long time for those places to sort of get back to where they are. Get back to that. Kristen, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, also too, Jeremy, the one thing that if you look at all those other cities, when you can't go wide, you can't go out anymore, you go up. And so we don't have that's how tertiary cities become secondary cities and secondary cities become primary cities. They're all up, they're vertical. So I think that downtown Las Vegas is showing us that. When we do the loop of 215, we don't see a lot of high rises, but I definitely think that we will be seeing a lot of high rises in the future. So,
oh boy, it sounds like Kristen's bringing back the Manhattanization of Las Vegas. We remember that one from a while back. I think you make an excellent point. Again, I'll turn it back over to you. And if there's any other questions, we're happy to try and answer them as a panel.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jeremy. I really appreciate it. Thank you to all of our panelists here. It's been an awesome conversation to be a part of, and I'm excited to hear where we can go from here. I know we have a lot of other questions, but we're just about out of time for the folks that are on the Zoom. So we want to make sure that we have an opportunity. If you have those questions on Zoom, please send them over and let's see what we can do to maybe continue this conversation as a group. We know this is just the beginning. We are just getting this conversation from a thought leadership standpoint started, and this has been a tremendous way to make it going. So Jeremy, thank you very much. Brian, Audra, Brian, Kristen, Tim, thank you very much for being a part of this and taking that first step with us. We're excited to be able to continue this as we move forward. And I think I heard a lot of great stuff about some of the things that we're talking about with education, with affordable housing, knowing that that's on the horizon there. Some of the other things that we know are going to be coming up as we talk about the land and even some of the new opportunities that could be coming into the market. We hear some of these other people that are moving in from out of state. How do we really push forward with that? I think the big question that I heard in a lot of cases was the labor force and how do we address that? And so we're excited to be able to continue this as we go down the line. And I want to stop and say thank you very much to our sponsors for being here and helping this conversation get started. So thank you very much, Southern Nevada Home Builders Association. Thank you very much, Nevada State Bank. We really appreciate you being here and being a part of this. And on behalf of the Las Vegas Review Journal, I just want to say thank you to everybody that has been attending on the Zoom call, everybody that's attended here in person. This is a great way for us to get started. We're excited to have had this opportunity to work with our partners at REQ and the Vegas Chamber to be able to bring this to the community and really be able to inculcate this idea of where do we go from here? This is a tremendous way for us to get started. Let's look at where do we go into the future. And with that, I would invite you to come back and join us for our next panel that we're going to be doing as we look in January, and we're going to be addressing the HR, the labor force, the workforce hiring, as we look to what does this mean for us. I think these are all going to be tied together as we're excited to be able to continue these topics and do more of this in the future. So once again, thank you very much for being a part of this. We're excited to see you again, and we'll see you from there.